Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books, drawing from a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Today's interview is with Bongray Siak, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Alvernia University. His new book, Moral Psychology of Confucian Shame, is just out from Roman and Littlefield. Shame is a complex social emotion that has a particularly negative valence in the West. It is associated with failure, inappropriateness, dishonor, disgrace. But within the Confucian tradition, there is, in addition, a distinct positive variety of moral shame, a virtue that, as Siak writes, is not for losers, but for self-reflective moral leaders. In his new book, Siak draws on textual evidence from Confucius, Mencius, and Xunzi, as well as contemporary moral psychology, anthropology, biology, linguistics, and ancient Greek philosophy, to illuminate one aspect of the rich Confucian tradition in moral psychology. Siak explains how moral shame involves the whole self's sensitivity to moral ideals, and how it supports the Confucian virtues of self-cultivation, self-reflection, and learning. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Bongray Siak. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to New Books in Philosophy. I'm looking forward to our conversation about your new book, Moral Psychology of Confucian Shame, subtitled The Shame of Shamelessness. Which is a really interesting mixture of, it's an interdisciplinary approach to a series of Confucian texts from Confucius, Mencius, and Xunzi. But it also mixes in contemporary moral psychology, anthropology, biology, linguistics. So it's a very different, very interdisciplinary approach that you take to articulating this special Confucian moral shame, very special sort of moral emotion.
Before
we get into the book itself, this is not your first book, in this area, I should say. You had a couple of years ago, you did a book on embodied moral psychology and Confucian philosophy. So could you say a bit about your background first as a philosopher and your work in this area?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having me in this wonderful opportunity to promote my book and myself. And in this book, Moral Psychology of Confucian Shame, I have another book came out 2 years ago, Embodied Moral Psychology and Confucian Philosophy, and also other papers and articles as well. What I do in these books, especially the book that is right now, is something that is kind of different from what most philosophers and psychologists do. I'm doing interdisciplinary and comparative moral psychology, which is kind of combining a bit of empirical studies of psychology and philosophy and Asian philosophy. This is quite kind of a different process of a philosophizing. What I do in those books and articles is basically, what can we learn from different traditions and different philosophies? There are a lot of things that are exciting and interesting, because in these traditions, they do certain emotions and develop them to put them to the level of morality and ethics that didn't happen in Western traditions. To my background, I studied philosophy. I also studied psychology, linguistics, and neuroscience. I had 3 years of experience in a neuroscience lab studying dorsolateral prefrontal cortex of primates. So all these things put together to come up with this wonderful viewpoint where I believe that morality ethics is not just abstract a priori study of human behavior. It can be also a study of human emotion, culture, and some of the things that we don't quite usually understand from different traditions of religion. So that's just general background of my interest and the background of my research in moral psychology.
Okay, well, it's a very unusual sort of background, and you're kind of poised to do this sort of work in a very unique sort of way. I would guess that most listeners are not familiar with Chinese philosophy, the Chinese traditions. So for a lot of people, thinking about the emotions and their role in moral psychology, as well as taking the perspective from Chinese philosophy and particularly Confucian philosophy, is sort of a very different sort of experience. So one of the things that you say right at the beginning, which really struck me, was the idea that shame is not for losers; it's for self-reflective moral leaders. And I thought that sentence nicely captured the sort of the take-home message, or at least a take-home message, of the book in terms of the development of a particular kind of shame, moral shame, within the Confucian tradition. Could you start out in the first chapter with sort of a general discussion of shame? It has many meanings. In fact, I think you say that in Chinese, there's something like 100 different words for shame, or in all the different nuances, which is pretty incredible. Could you explain a bit in general, how you introduce the topic of shame, the emotion, and the different sorts of shame that even traditions in the West, we do recognize different types of shame. Right. So, yeah, could you just give us a little bit of that background?
Sure. I would say cultural specialization here. Different cultures specializing in different kind of things. And whenever we hear China or Chinese, the first thing that comes to our mind is Chinese food, right? So it's a wonderful kind of a traditional food. But here I talk about moral psychology. And shame in this context is quite enriched and extended and expanded to cover many different aspects of emotion and human behavior. As you mentioned, there are probably about 100 different, I'm just citing the research paper recently published on, that's not my paper though, on concepts of shame in Chinese culture. So if you look at that, it's actually more than 100 different meanings. But in general, shame is self-critical emotion. That's for sure true, regardless of East and West. So that's kind of the foundation. But in Chinese tradition, they elaborate, enrich, and to diversify to cover different aspects of human behavior, human morality, and human culture. So to begin with, if we say shame is a self-critical emotion, we can compare that to guilt. Shame and guilt, these are sister emotions, and in that way they probably in the same category, but they are quite different. In shame, for example, in English we have shame as a one word, but we probably can differentiate different different meanings of shame, so like shame in shamefulness and shame in shamelessness. They are kind of different. If you look at European languages, German, Italian, French, Spanish, they actually have at least two different words, lexical items to cover the emotion of shame. So they do a little better than English. The English is just to kind of put all these things together as just one word, but those other European languages has at least two or three different words to deal with different aspects of shame. Now, in Chinese tradition, shame is number one self-critical emotion, but it also, I'm talking about moral shame. We'll talk about social shame and other types of shame later. To discuss Confucian moral shame, we have to say self-critical emotion, but it comes with some type of audience, which is kind of interesting, and that comes with bodily expressions, like the blushed face or some type of body postures or some type of behavioral traits. And most importantly, it, in a way, hijacking is kind of my expression. Hijack the whole person. It's not quite discreet in the sense that it doesn't focus on certain aspects of the person, the person's action, behavior, relations, but it really criticizing and blaming the whole person. So it's quite strong and holistic, and at the same time embodied and self-critical. So if you put all these things together, suddenly the Confucius and his followers put that to the level of moral sensitivity. So shame in Confucian tradition is moral sense, basically. It's moral sense. They just use the term shame, but what they discuss actually is moral sense. You have to be morally sensitive. That's the same as you have to be shame sensitive person. So that was the one of the recommendations of the master Confucius himself when he was asked to give lifelong lesson of Confucianism. He said, think of shame in the sense of moral sense. You have to be sensitive to the rightness and wrongness. So that's how I get interested in Confucian shame.
Okay, so to go into the different degrees and types of shame a little bit more specifically, you mentioned it's a self-critical emotion, East and West, and it's certainly that's that idea that, you know, I'm ashamed, as one might say. And there's also that other sense of something being inappropriate, or where you'd say in English, you know, have you no shame? You know, have you no sense of what's appropriate to do? And those, as you just mentioned, they tend to get mushed together in English with just one single word that gets, they are differentiated in Spanish and French and so forth. But in you go on before going to the very specific aspects of Confucian moral shame. You actually do a very nice taxonomy between three different main senses, I guess, of shame. What you call subordination shame, social shame, and then, of course, moral shame, which is not, I take it, is not limited to the Confucian version. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, but it's a specific type, and then Confucius and his followers elaborate it in a particular way appropriate for his teachings. So could you say a bit about those three basic, you know, types in your taxonomy of shame before we get into the details of the Confucian articulation of it?
Yes. That's a really wonderful question. That actually was discussed in one of the chapters of my book. I kind of connect that to the discussion of evolution or development of shame from more biological survival sense of shame to more ethical and moral sense of shame. So those three categories or types can be understood from the perspective of not only from the viewpoint of philosophy, but also viewpoint of biology and sociology and other things. So subordination shame is a behavioral display to show that you are subordinate. You are inferior to that person. So I give up, I give in to you. Don't attack me, kind of a signal showing shown to the individuals and other social groups. And typically, animal psychologists and biologists report this kind of animal behavior in the process of recognition of authority. To many of these social animals have these behavioral display to show their inferiority so that they can deal with any kind of aggressive behaviors. So that's quite basic form of shame. And the next one is social shame. Social shame is quite strong in many of the cultures of face. So face culture is a culture where individuals kind of recognize each other and their behaviors from the perspective of their social relations, from the perspective of their kind of a social regulations and other rules and the principles. So that they, when they look at their behaviors and their actions, they always think of others. If I do what other people think of me, so that's the context where they develop sense of shame. It's a strong process to regulate individual behaviors, but it's quite different from the sense of morality as we know from Western philosophy, like Kantian philosophy of moral autonomy. Moral autonomy is the sense of morality where you think of yourself as the individual decision maker, and you don't have to. I mean, you probably will, but you don't have to think of others' viewpoint, because you really have to look at yourself and to ask whether I act to live up to my universal principle of categorical imperatives, for example. So that's quite different kind of a way of think of actions and behaviors in a social settings. That's a social shame. The next one is moral shame, and moral shame is when people continually look at his or her own action from the perspective of ideal authority, not necessarily actual authority, but the ideal authority that could be your teachers and masters or even yourself to regulate your action as if those ideal authority figures are something that's always looking at you, which sounds a little different from regulation of actions based on autonomy. So this is not autonomy, but this is something that they found, they meaning Confucians, classical Confucian philosophers found very important as kind of a living up to his or her own virtues, that we always think of ourselves from the perspective of ideal moral authority. So that's the third form of shame. Now, the reason these three forms of shame look different and they function differently. But why do I think they are in a way connected? I think they're connected because they have certain type of behavioral and psychological traits together. So that's kind of an evolutionary viewpoint that they evolved or changed and developed into different kind of psychological states and dispositions. But in a way, they share certain things in common. They have bodily display and they have certain recognition of authority, and they are not really solipsistic Cartesian kind of a process of understanding each other. It's more like socially open ways of interacting each other and understanding each other. So for these kind of features and characteristics, I think they have certain things in common. So they probably evolved or developed from the same foundation, but in the end, they become quite different ways and processes of understanding and regulating human behaviors.
Okay, so you mentioned face culture, and that's a very familiar concept. The idea of losing face, for example, is very familiar, and I think you know, sort of stereotypically, perhaps recognized, you know, that certain cultures, maybe Asian or certain Chinese cultures or something, there is a certain amount of losing face that one does not encounter as much, if at all, in a Western society. We may have something similar. You don't want to do anything to embarrass yourself, but I'm not sure that that one would characterize Western cultures, say, as face cultures. Given the broad familiarity with the idea of losing face, that sort of shame, which is, I think, the social shame that you mentioned. What is the difference between that sense of shame and then the specifically moral sense? Like if somebody, you know, what would be situations in which one might have the one but not the other?
Yeah. So actually, that was really hard part of my argument. Whenever we discuss shame, we end up discussing something about how can that be moral emotion? It looks like more like social emotion,
right?
But not moral emotion. So how are we going to distinguish those different aspects of shame? It's a wonderful question to ask. And on my part, I think I have to start from a little bit towards the foundational issues first, and then I will give some specific answers to that question. So at the beginning, we tend to think of morality and ethics, moral behaviors and dispositions and virtues. We tend to think of certain type of template, like the utilitarian consequentialism or Kantian deontology or Aristotelian virtue ethics or social contract theory. But what I think is kind of important is, okay, can we think in terms of more concrete and specific interaction of human being? And that's one of the things I found really important in my first book, which is Embodied Moral Psychology, which is basically this. Can we think of morality and ethics from the perspective of situational and contextual and relation-specific way of understanding on human existence and human being? So that was kind of a bigger picture that I'm interested in. And then I found body. So body, what I mean by body is not just this kind of internal organs and, this kind of biological structure. It's more about concrete interaction of individuals to their environment. That's basically my meaning of body. The Merleau-Ponty said sensory motor exploration to the world. A.J. Gibson said, ecological understanding. So all these things are basically telling us that there is a dimension of human being and human behavior where we have to look at this situational, contextual, and relation-based activity. So that's kind of thing. Now, shame here is, I think it's almost 90% moral shame. I'm talking moral shame. Confucian moral shame is 90% similar to guilt. It's basically like guilt, but the kind of things that shame, the Chinese Confucian understanding of shame that's unique is this sense, this moral sense, almost like guilt, does not give up situational, context-sensitive, relation-sensitive meanings of morality and ethics, which translate into having certain type of bodily display and authority recognition. These things are there, not in a heteronomous, non-moral submission of oneself to the authority. No, not in that sense. It's more towards the sense of our concrete emotional and moral experience. And I think shame represents that direction of morality and ethics. So make kind of a quick, shame is important moral emotion. It's not just social emotion, it's a moral emotion because I believe, or many people believe, that we have sense of right and wrong to the whole self and to the emotion. And sometimes we physically and physiologically respond to those things, like disgust. Disgust is very straight, strong. Emotion and disgust itself is not purely moral emotion, but it also be associated with moral reactions as well, like some of the Jonathan Haidt's work and Jesse Prince's work would indicate. So shame has that kind of dimension that we should focus on and to look at, to analyze, that we realize that shame is not just a social emotion. It's a kind of unique emotion. It has the moral sense, but it also comes with some of these so-called vestigial traits that may confuse some people, but it's important part of that because these embodied and authority-based process of moral recognition is not compromising the pure sense of morality, but actually give more sense of situational and context-based and relational-based sense of morality. So in that way, I believe that shame is a wonderful moral emotion.
Well, you distinguish it from guilt, although they're closely related. So let me just follow up on that issue. Guilt is not something that we kind of seek out, right? People may be guilty for something, for having done something, but it's not a pleasant emotion. You know, it doesn't feel pleasant, and it's generally categorized as a negative emotion. And shame. One of the points that you make throughout the book and in a number of different ways is that shame is typically coded in a negative way also, but your point is, no, it's actually a positive emotion. So given the way that how closely related it is to guilt, which is a negative emotion, how do you get the positive in the moral shame given its closeness to guilt?
Okay, so that's something I actually needed some help from psychology literature on shame and guilt. And in fact, we have many wonderful publications on that matter. You said that guilt is negative emotion, which is, I think, halfway right, not completely right.
Okay.
Because, yes, it's self-critical emotion. Yes, it's self-critical emotion. It's you blaming yourself. So in that way, it's negative. That's true. And shame, same. Shame is also self-critical emotion. But there's some differences. One of the major differences there is guilt motivates constructive kind of behaviors. So when a person realizes his or her moral errors and mistakes, and then he or she feels guilt, and then he or she does something that can change things so that they can go move out of guilt. Shame, from the perspective of Western psychology, I should emphasize that, from the perspective of Western psychology, shame motivates escape. And the shame motivates covering up, escape. So it's typically associated with some of the morally compromising behaviors afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the guilt motivates more constructive, reparative, kind of repairing the situation type of traits and dispositions. So it looks like they both start out with a self-critical emotional foundation, but their motivations are kind of different. Mm-hmm. And their how should I describe that? Their impact on these individuals are quite different. So shame has more frontal attack to the whole person. So usually in the experience of shame, individuals feel strongly about their whole self is crushed in front of other people's in a more stronger than the level of embarrassment. Embarrassment is lighthearted kind of awkward situation. But if you reach out to the level of shame, you are really attacked, or your sense of self is damaged, perhaps in front of others, or, I mean, without others around still, you see that kind of a damage. Guilt, on the other hand, the damage is minimal. That's what psychologists report. Mm-hmm. So guilt is more discrete. They're focusing on certain aspects of self, not the whole self. So in terms of motivation, in terms of damage, guilt is probably better than, better meaning manageable. Mm-hmm. And in a way more morally prospective than shame. Shame is more destructive. So that's the perception of Western psychology. Now, what I think is different, the whole idea of Confucian shame is, hey, shame can be positive as well. It can motivate positive things. And it may criticize those individuals, but it can make things more progressively so that these individuals become better individuals. So Confucian shame, trying hard to show more positive options of shame that are kind of comparable to guilt or perhaps better than guilt. So that's what I see from the discussions of psychology and philosophy and anthropology. Now, how is that possible? How is shame be? How can shame be constructive and positive? That's really the puzzle. Mm-hmm. And there are many answers, but my answer is perhaps it's the different orientations of culture that in the I shouldn't say Asian because it's not just Asian. Any kind of a collectivist culture. This is termed by Harry Triandis, and he's a social psychologist and talks about collectivism and individualism. So it's actually a psychological terms. So in collectivist culture, they tend to emphasize the relations and contexts and social interactions more than individual responsibility and individual moral and social actions. So they tend to focus more about relational contexts. They tend to it's a kind of quite controversial. They tend to minimize autonomy. Autonomy is very strong in individualist cultures. So if you put that into the perspective, in Chinese or Asian, or perhaps in, I heard that some of these Mediterranean cultures has the elements of collectivism. So it's not just Asian, but any kind of collectivist culture see shame as, relatively speaking, positive emotion. It's not necessarily negative. Why? Because the attack or the blame on the whole self is kind of manageable. Why? Because the self is not just individual self in those cultures. Self is socially open to other people, so that this kind of a challenge and self-criticism can be manageable. What that basically means is individuals can open up and can be ready to change and modify and revise their selves and their identities, perhaps more easily than those individuals in individualist cultures. So if that's the case, then it's a good environment where they can explore more positive sides of shame and other self-critical emotions.
I see. I think so. This is maybe a crude way of putting it, but when one feels this type of shame, one is thinking roughly, I ought to be a better social person, something to that effect, rather than I've done something wrong, I'm a bad person, I should try to be better, which has a very individualistic tinge to it. And right. You're saying that because the self itself is conceived of in a more, as you put it, collectivist manner, the onus of the correction or the improvement is I ought to participate better in the collective in which I'm ensconced or something like that.
That's very good way of putting the idea. I like to add just one thing. Mm-hmm. If you put that way, once again, shame is going to be positive social emotion. So how are we going to put the moral part there?
Right.
The thing that these classical Confucian philosophers put their writings is, okay, so you really have to think not only of yourself, but also other people and your community, which is a good thing, which is basically what Bernard Williams discussed in his book on shame, which is a wonderful book, by the way. So community is important. Other people is important. But Confucians add to that list ideal moral characters and figures. So it's not just existing communities and people, but also you can really think of ideal characters and people and figures that you can live up to. So that's kind of an extra dimension there that pushes and motivates people to cultivate their virtues.
I see. Okay. So that sounds a bit a bit like Aristotelian virtue theory, right? But would you agree with that?
I think in a way, yes, it's kind of similar to Aristotelian theory of shame. Once again, there's some critical differences, and one of the differences is Aristotle recognized the value of shame. Yeah, that's true. But he didn't give status of virtue to shame. So shame is important emotion. Shame is wonderful moral disposition. But wait a minute, shame is not a virtue. And at that point, I think, okay, so it's quite kind of different viewpoints. The reason Aristotle didn't put shame in his list of virtue means moral excellence. Moral, it's not just a moral disposition, it's moral excellence, something you really have to aspire to become. Mm. And the reason he didn't put shame in his list is because shame is good developmental disposition. So you can really reflect upon yourself. You want to be better human person. So that's good. But then he says, if you are completely virtuous, if you are become mature, morally mature, you may never practice shame because you may not really criticize yourself in the first place. So it's good for developmental purposes, but it may not be good for the higher levels of a virtue.
Okay. I mentioned at the start of the conversation, there's three figures that you discuss in relation to shame and the development of the concept, Confucius, obviously, Mencius, and Shunzi. Could you say something about what each of them has contributed to this this concept of moral shame? I mean, I know that's a large question, so perhaps you want to focus on one particular aspect of its development from Confucius himself through to these other philosophers.
Great. Yes, that's actually the kind of discussion I developed in the second half of my book. Confucius obviously is the founder of the tradition, but let me specify a little bit. Confucius is part of this tradition called the Ru tradition. So in China, Japan, and Korea, in Vietnam, they usually say Ru tradition. So that pre-exists Confucius' time. So Confucius is actually part of that tradition, but from the Western audience, it's always a Confucian tradition. So yes, it's the same tradition anyway. So Confucius is really the first major figure in that tradition, and he said shame is important. So he's really the first one who mentioned several times in his book that shame is one of the major virtues of a Ru tradition. Now, that may be a little controversial from the perspective of Western philosophers and audience. So at the back of my book, I actually did a little bit of a digital humanities, which is I look at all these ancient classical Confucian texts, and I search how many times shame is mentioned in those passages. It turned out that shame is as frequently appeared as the discussion of moral courage. So that's how important shame is. I mean, it's just a numerical calculation, but I can just put that as a side note that, hey, this is actually important virtue. So Confucius recognized the sense of shame as the sense of morality, as the one major disposition, even to the level of virtue on ideal moral agents. So that's what Confucius did. And Mencius is a very interesting philosopher. He did a lot of moral psychology, actually. And I always compare Mencius to David Hume. So that's kind of the sense we can get. Mencius says, shame is the foundation of innate moral, emotional ability of the human mind for the sake of the sense of rightness. Yeah, So he talks about different Confucian virtues and their innate foundations. And he says shame is one of those innate foundations, specifically to the Confucian virtue of righteousness. So that's Mencius. And Shenzi is also a great Confucian philosopher. And he specifically developed the normative dimension of shame. So shame is, yes, natural human emotion, but he also discussed appropriate sense of shame and inappropriate sense of shame. What that means is shame has normative dimension. So when you feel shame, if your personal ego is damaged, Shenzi said, no, that's not appropriate shame. The appropriate moral shame is when you do something and that doesn't live up to your ideal self. Then that's appropriate sense of shame. But it's not just damaging to your ego. That's different kind. That's not really appropriate moral shame. So Shenzi is quite importantly saw this normative dimension of shame, and he also talked about how to cultivate and develop shame in a right way, which is kind of different from Mencius. Mencius believed that shame is our natural emotion. It's an innate moral orientation. But Shenzi said, no, we don't have that specific moral foundation. We have this domain general learning ability. So use that domain general learning ability to develop morally specific dispositions. So that's Shenzi's approach to shame.
Okay, yeah. So one of the points you do make in the book is that it is, at least for Shenzi, it's an acquired emotion. It's not some, maybe we have the ability, where maybe we're born with the ability to develop it, but it just doesn't develop as a matter of course. You have to have, it has to be in the right sort of cultural or social context. Is that's correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. For Shenzi is not moral nativist. He believed that we just have general domain, general learning capacity. And from there, we really have to develop morally specific action dispositions. So Shenzi is quite opposite to Mencius' viewpoint.
Okay. So, we've sort of made various distinctions as we've talked between Western approaches or thoughts about shame and conceptions of shame, and then this specifically Confucian one or Eastern or Ru tradition. So would somebody in the West today be able to cultivate this sense of moral shame? Is it something that an individual can do in the West, or is it the sort of thing that essentially requires you to be in a particular context or social context, and you just can't get this moral excellence unless you're in the right sort of context? It's not something that you can even hope to attain on your own.
Right, that's quite interesting question. So one of the things I think I actually discussed that earlier, but one of the things that I realized as when I wrote this book is how different these cultural perceptions are, not just in terms of behaviors, but also in terms of morality and ethics. But I believe that shame is one of the innate moral emotions. Now, shame is not part of innate moral or emotional reservoir of human psychology, probably not, but it's quite close to that, because In any culture, we recognize and understand shame. I mean, there's some different degrees of understanding, but in any culture, we have that. But more importantly, shame has specific set of embodied reactions. Specific may not be specific in terms of facial reactions, but it's kind of specific in terms of behavioral traits and other gestures and body languages usually associated with shame. That's kind of cross-cultural. So yes, it's possibilities open. It's just that industrialized capitalist or perhaps Western societies, they really emphasize individual autonomy. So we don't really have, abundant opportunity where we experience the genuine original kind of shame that Confucian philosophers talked about. But I think we can, in a way, that the whole message behind the classical Confucian philosophy is you really have to be invested on right and good. It's not just part of yourself. It's your whole self is dedicated to the right and good, and most likely you feel shame, which is shame is the holistic sense of morality, and it's embodied. It's contextual and embodied. Like you feel something wrong in your action, and when that happens, your whole self is respond to that, and sometimes your heart beats and you sweat and you breathe roughly, and all these things happen. And let me give one example from Mencius. Mencius has many interesting passages, and in one of those passages, Mencius specifically talks about this physiological and embodied reactions to moral wrong. So he says, okay, you gotta do this, but if you don't do that, you sense and you experience, your heart beats fast, you sweat, and you didn't, you cannot even look up straight. And all these things are quite interesting because he says, oh, these are how deeply, these are the things that you're deeply involved in the domains of right and wrong. And these are not just external appearance. These are not external appearances. These are not just many kind of minor manifestations of your moral mind. No, it's actually your centerpiece of your moral mind. It's coming out of the core self. That's what Mencius said. So shame is not, I should say moral shame. Moral shame is not far away. It's whenever you experience your whole self is responding to some of the immoral actions and decisions, then that's probably the context where you feel some kind of shame. So it's not far away from us.
Okay. So let me just to sort of follow that up. What are the sort of typical triggers, I guess, of moral shame, and what are the typical outcomes or behavioral sequelae, I guess, of mm-hmm. moral shame? So I'm thinking, for example, to take another moral excellence virtue. Another virtue such as courage, right, which Aristotle recognizes, and I would guess that courage is also recognized in some sense in the Confucian tradition. So with courage, you're faced with a frightening or difficult some sort of situation, and the outcome is some sort of behavior of facing that threat or that difficult situation in some way, rather than, paradigmatically running away or hiding or something like that. So that's courage. That's an easy one that we all get. If you're feeling, what does moral shame do between what sorts of inputs, social circumstances, and what are the sorts of behaviors that are typical of someone who is responding to that with moral shame rather than someone who lacks that emotion?
Okay. I think I'd like to discuss perhaps two examples. Hope that helps. First, I'd like to discuss anger. So anger is obviously negative emotion, and anger is quite destructive, obviously. But anger also, I mean, in the right context, anger is a moral emotion. So you find something not right in a really gigantic dimension, and you find something totally wrong, and sometimes you get angry. But at the same time, anger is psychological stress and psychological burden. I mean, anger is directed to certain situations or certain people, but also it really kind of puts the burden on the person who is angry. So in a kind of similar fashion, we can understand shame. So shame is obviously, kind of a negative emotion, self-critical emotion, but at the same time, it has a dimension of moral sense and even moral development. And in some ways, some of the social psychologists and philosophers sometimes ask me, shame is probably one of the major causes of a higher suicide rates in Asian cultures. And that may be true, because shame itself is quite negative. But we are discussing moral shame, not social shame. So when we look at some of the elements of shame that are quite closely related to social relations and the face to other people, yes, sometimes bad things happen, and those individuals are under the pressure of kind of a suicidal, motivations. So there's some bad things, but really the genuinely good things about shame is your clear understanding of immorality and wrongness of action. That is quite clear. So that should be there. I mean, without having that kind of sense, you're not going to experience shame in the first place. So that should be there. And also, you have to have the clear dedication and commitment to your self-integrity and your dedication to virtue and morality. That's also should be part of moral shame. And combined together, you have this stressful situation, but because you have probably stronger motivation of cultivating higher virtues, you can flexibly and resiliently move over and overcome some of these negative consequences, psychological consequences of shame. Now, the other thing that I really like to say is appropriate context of moral shame, the whole self is in stake. So you find something wrong, and your whole self is responding to that, and most likely some of these bad things are actually coming out of you. So the sense of self is really important. In the case of guilt, the whole self is not attacked or damaged, because guilt is more discrete emotion. But shame, it's not discrete, it's holistic. So there may be some chance that the agency or moral self is damaged or destroyed, which is really the main concern of Western psychology and Western philosophy. In Confucian tradition, that's not necessarily the case. So that yourself is not completely fixed permanent self. You and I and all people have to understand that the self is always changing and growing and developing and always ready to take new possibilities and options. So the understanding of self is absolutely important in shame. So again, Confucianism is not Buddhism, but still Confucianism, in Confucianism, the understanding of self is quite developmental and open. They don't believe that self is permanently fixed orientation of human beings, so that you always can adjust and always can modify and change so that you can cultivate ideal virtues. So that's all I can say about that.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's there's a lot more to, you know, to consider. I mean, there's obviously a whole lot of other features to the Confucian tradition and its metaphysics as well as its ethical elements. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I guess readers will or listeners will have to read your book and perhaps delve more into Eastern philosophical traditions in order to understand these various elements of Confucian shame and its place within the larger context of that entire philosophical tradition. But since we're out of time, I just want to close with one final question, which is, what are you working on now? I mean, this particular book, there was a prior book, and again, there's other works that you have published in the same area of moral psychology and Confucian philosophical traditions and blending those two. Are you working on another volume in this particular area, or are you moving to something else entirely?
I am right now preparing another project, which concerns moral psychology of psychopathy. And I'd like to say, first of all, that Confucian tradition is wonderful tradition of moral psychology. It's really, I can't emphasize enough on that. It's wonderful tradition of moral psychology. It focuses on different aspects of mind, specifically other regarding or other concerning emotions. And they also look at moral cultivation and development. So developmental aspect is there, and also affective reaction to others' pain and suffering is there as well. So if we combine these two, I think we can develop wonderful methodological or theoretical framework to study and understand psychopathy. So psychopathy right now is based on the Hare's psychopathy checklist. Then if you look at the list, and there's many different kind of features and characteristics, and you give different different points, and then in the end you collect all these numbers and you decide whether the person is psychopathic or not. But I think all these different characteristics, we in a way combine together to have some holistic picture of psychopaths. What's wrong? I mean, what's right or what's wrong with those kind of people? And I think Confucian tradition gives us some interesting answers to that question.
Okay. Well, I know you mentioned the some major psychopathologies in this particular book as well towards the end, but I don't want to get into that at the very, very end, and we'll just leave that for listeners to pursue themselves. So in the meantime, I wish you luck with your new projects, and I thank you again for talking with us on New Books in Philosophy.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Bongre Seok. Associate Professor of Philosophy at Alvernia University. We've been talking about his new book, Moral Psychology of Confucian Shame, Shame of Shamelessness, which is just out from Roman and Littlefield. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and thank you once more for listening.